From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. Lawmakers are back in Washington to put the finishing touches on a coronavirus relief package, and we'll hear from Congressman Dan Kildee.
There's no way we can deal with a pandemic like this without really effective government intervention. And this is proving that, and I hope it's a lesson that sticks.
Also, we'll revisit a conversation about the legacy of Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance in Michigan.
Most of us thought, and we continue to think, that Hoffa's body was destroyed as quickly as possible.
And we'll lighten the mood into the weekend with our March movie madness.
8 Mile and Grosse Pointe not only have a lot of Michigan locations in them, but they also kind of seem to embody the spirit of Michigan for me.
Those conversations and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. Congress has approved the massive relief package to aid Americans and businesses during the global COVID-19 pandemic. I recently spoke with Congressman Dan Kildee from his home in Flint Township. He was preparing to drive, not fly, back to the Capitol to vote. Here's our conversation. So you are living a life that is generally very jet set, and lawmakers have to fly in and out of D.C. very often. Are you used to driving back and forth? Is this kind of a new normal for you as well?
You know, I typically about twice a year I would make the drive just because logistics dictate it. Maybe I have to move something. But normally, you know, every week I'm on a flight either, you know, Sunday or Monday or Thursday or Friday. We are all on that same flight back and forth. And this is really unusual. It's very rare that I'm in the same location, let alone my own home, for that many days in a row. So this is really an unusual thing.
Your family is probably enjoying that, though.
Yeah, I mean, my kids are sort of scattered. They're all doing well. There is something nice about being at home. But, you know, it seemed as though the work would be easier not traveling back and forth. But it's hard. We are on conference calls literally all day long of one form or another. And it's just more difficult to communicate when we don't have the normal informal communication that takes place in the hallway, in the office, on the floor of the house. None of that's happening.
So the working from home conundrum bleeds into the public sector as well.
It really does. Yeah. It really does.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the fallibility of sectors in our economy. It seems to me that as we've moved progressively towards a service-based economy and away from making things, that sort of makes workers particularly vulnerable, not just in the day-to-day life, but especially during something like a pandemic, where it's not about whether or not we can transition our work into what makes sense, for instance, retooling an auto plant to make ventilators, but rather having to socially distance from the thing that comes and consumes your product. But that maybe this pandemic shows the weakness of that.
I think it does. I mean, I think many of us over the years have made the case that we need to reclaim our manufacturing legacy, that we can't essentially become a consumer-based economy, and that we offshore manufacturing. We always have sort of said, implied, that this is a national security problem. We always thought of that as coming in the form of some external military threat or
right.
Something of that nature.
A war, sure.
But now we can see that one of the problems we have is that we haven't been able to quickly turn and manufacture all the products that we need. I will say this. I've been impressed by the extent to which even large and very small businesses have been able to quickly re-engineer and retool their processes.
Sure. Distilleries making hand sanitizer,
yeah.
Et cetera.
The point being, though, we need to have a plan so that we have the capacity not just to support an economy that is based on manufacturing, but to be able to retool that manufacturing base in a moment of need, such as the one we're going through right now.
Do you think that the urgency and severity of this pandemic will, you know, it's rewiring a lot of our brains to think about how often we're touching our faces, how often we're coming in contact with large groups of people, what it means to be social. You know, we're thinking about things we haven't otherwise thought about as a society in a very long time, if ever. Do you think that it also will rewire some of the thinking in Washington about what's important going forward and how to have debates about bolstering the United States, both practically and economically?
I hope it does. You know, the concern we always have is that we talk about the lessons that a tragedy or something as dramatic a tragedy as this will deliver. And then we look back and we sometimes question whether or not those lessons were learned at all. I think we have to make the point through this crisis that this could cause us to rethink the way we do things. I'll tell you the big one for me is that we are getting major legislation through the House and the Senate in a bipartisan fashion. You know, the fact that we can't find the same urgency to build 21st century infrastructure or to invest in 21st century cures, unless there's a crisis that is literally threatening our very way of life. If there is a big lesson for Washington, it's that we've proven that when push comes to shove, we can come together, even in the most divided era of my lifetime. If we can't figure out a way to carry that forward, it will have been an even greater tragedy than what we're experiencing.
Part of what we see in this package is, dare I use the word socialism, but there are socialist aspects to a community of sharing and the government giving money to people, whether they're individuals or large corporations or even small businesses right in the middle. Do you think that it could cause some shifting perspective around the role of government in the average American life?
I think it should have an effect on the way people think about government, because for about 40 years, there has been this steady drumbeat that government is the problem, that government, that everything government touches goes wrong. And so rather than arguing it on its merit, there's been this effect or this determination to demonize and minimize and really caricature government as not being able to solve big problems. That does not serve us well. We can have a decent argument about where the line should be drawn and where government should have its role. But I think it's been dangerous and I think very unhelpful to demonize what we do together through our government, through the institution that we all own and share. And when we come to a moment like this, where it's especially important that people can trust the government to make the right decisions and to provide them with accurate information, to have had those two principles threatened, that government can't be trusted, and that never makes the right decisions, undermines our ability to respond to a moment like this. That's an important lesson. There's no way we can deal with a pandemic like this without really effective government intervention. And this is proving that. And I hope it's a lesson that sticks.
Would you see a movement or a push for something like universal basic income out of this if people are going to be given a check that says this is reasonable to give to just about everybody for the pain and suffering and loss that you are going to go through no matter what through this pandemic? Here is $1,200 just to see you through the next month. Do you think that that could become a push to maybe create a program around something that is recurring, whether on a monthly basis, quarterly, or yearly?
I think it's a good question, and I think that debate will come up. There's two pieces of this. One is whether we should have a floor of decency below which we allow no American to ever fall, that the basic elements necessary for survival should never be threatened. I think there is going to be much broader agreement about that. What form that may take, I think, is a technical question, whether it's universal basic income, some like that, some don't. But there are other ways to deliver through the mechanisms of the safety net, a basic level of floor of decency so that housing, food, water, the basic elements of survival are never in question. I agree with that. And this pandemic, like Katrina did in New Orleans, in a way, rips the cover off just how many people in this country can't depend on the basic elements of survival. In the richest country in the world, at its richest moment, we should never let that be.
Representative Dan Kildee from Michigan's 5th District, thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope that your family stays well through all of it.
Thank you so much. You too.
Kids are wrapping up week 2 of staying home because of the COVID-19 pandemic. What started out as perhaps a fun break from school is starting to, well, shift. Students from Community High School in Ann Arbor called our hotline to share what's on their minds as they continue to adjust to their new reality.
Hey, so I got that emergency alert this evening from the governor stating that people couldn't go outside for kind of frivolous reasons. You know, it's like another step of making it seem more real and more scary.
Hi. So the first few days of our quarantine were pretty blissful. My mom has asthma, so we were being super extra cautious, and we still are being, but it was really just kind of us in the house, and that was great.
It's been a pretty weird week. I ran out of toothpaste at home, and I was driving to the pharmacy to get it. Well, unfortunately, the pharmacy was closed, which kind of threw a wrench in my plans.
I am actually baking a ton of chocolate chip cookies.
I'm getting along better with my 12-year-old brother, so that's good. It's like 7:55 in the morning, and I just woke up. So all of our work for the rest of the year, for most of my classes, is just like enrichment material. Like, we can't get a grade on it. And it's just like the fact that we can't get a grade on it, it's making me realize that, like, I did things for a grade versus for my own. I can't really find the motivation to do anything, honestly.
As much as it's hard to be inside all the time, I think that it's a really good time to do some kind of self-exploration and self-reflection. So, yeah. Okay, bye.
We just heard from students at Community High School in Ann Arbor, and that piece was produced by Michigan Radio's Rachel Ishikawa. Support for Michigan Radio comes from the Michigan Health Endowment Fund and the Children's Foundation. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. If you're looking for a long movie to pass the time as you stay at home, consider Martin Scorsese's latest film, The Irishman, on Netflix. It stars Al Pacino as one of Detroit's own mafia legends, Teamsters president Jimmy Hoffa. Nearly 45 years after Hoffa went missing, it's strange to think how large this character still looms in Michigan lore. Let's revisit a conversation about the life and death of Jimmy Hoffa. I had the conversation with Scott Bernstein. He's an author and expert on organized crime in America. And Greg Stascoll. He served as FBI agent for 31 years and retired as resident agent in charge of the Ann Arbor field office. So, Scott, remind us about why Jimmy Hoffa, the leader of a prominent workers' union, got tied up with the mob.
Well, I don't think he would have been involved in the workers' union or wouldn't have risen to the heights that he had without the mob. So they were kind of, in some ways, interchangeable.
So when did that relationship start?
In the 1930s. Hoffa came here as a young boy from Brazil, Indiana, started to make his name as a labor organizer at a very young age. He was working the docks at Kroger, unpacking produce. And he, when he was, I think he was only about 20 or 21, he led what became known as the Strawberry Strike, where he organized a lot of dock workers for better wages. And it came to be known in labor circles. And he was kind of recruited by the Teamsters. And through the Teamsters Union, he was introduced to the mob by a woman who was kind of a paramour, a mob paramour that dated a lot of different gangsters, and the rest was history.
What was the Teamsters Union, and why was it so significant in being connected to the mob?
Well, the Teamsters Union was the most powerful labor union in the world. It represented truck drivers, cartage haulers, various blue-collar working class men and women. In a lot of ways, Jimmy Hoffa becoming the president of the Teamsters became the face of the working man in America. They were so powerful because they controlled commerce. Jimmy Hoffa, as the president of the Teamsters, could pretty much shut down America with a phone call. And there was this relationship with the mafia where he gave them access to the pension fund. He gave them access to jobs and contracts within the union infrastructure. But in return, they gave him muscle. They gave him the support they needed on kind of the black market to make everything run smoothly. And
I think it's important to note that Hoffa built the Teamsters, and he built it into the largest and probably at the time the most effective union in the United States. And part of his ability to do that was his, again, the symbiotic relationship with the mob. And in order for Jimmy Hoffa to operate and to build the union into the force that it was, he had to have that relationship with the mob. And again, it went both ways. They helped him and he helped them.
It's muscle and influence.
So, Greg, you start with the FBI in 1975, the same year that Jimmy Hoffa went missing. What was it like to be part of and be a new agent in the FBI during that period of time in the 1970s?
Yeah, well, I got to Detroit, reported to Detroit from Quantico, and it was June of 1975. So it was about 2 months later that Hoffa was abducted. And that, among several other cases that happened to come down that year, I thought, wow, this is just like the movies. But on that period, and we didn't get involved with the Hoffa case right away. It was several days before the FBI actually got involved. But when we did, it was all hands on deck. And I think every available agent, and me being a relatively new agent, we went up and we were doing what we call neighborhood investigations and interviewing people and interviewing everybody that we could find, including people that had been customers at the Maccas Red Fox that day and all the surrounding businesses and everything.
How did you find out? How did you and your colleagues find out that he was missing?
Well, it was reported. Obviously, it was front
national
page.
It was national news. I
mean, yeah.
But did the FBI find out at the same time that the general public found out that he was missing? Was this something that had been leaked to the press first?
Well, it wasn't really leaked to the press. I mean, it was reported. He went to meet. He thought to meet Tony Giacalone.
He was going to a mob sit down with Tony Giacalone, who was the street boss of the Detroit Mafia, as well as a prominent New Jersey mobster by the name of Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano, and they were going to discuss Teamsters business, specifically Hoffa's desire to reclaim the Teamsters presidency that he had given up about 5 years earlier.
And then he didn't return home. And his wife, of course, alerted his family. And ultimately, I believe it was his son, James, Hoffa's son, James, that reported it to the police. The state police and the local police got involved. And then within a day or so, the FBI became involved. But there were issues as to what was our jurisdiction. A missing person is obviously not within the federal jurisdiction. But ultimately, we characterized it as a kidnapping, as a way to get involved. And then we became involved more so because of the organized crime issues and some of the other things that were involved.
So what happened there from there, Scott, as far as the organized crime element? What did the group of people that would have been most closely tied to Hoffa do in that period of time?
They went into a giant disinformation campaign, which was kind of the brilliance, in my opinion, of pulling off what could be called the perfect murder. They went into a mode where they were spreading lies and, you know, telling 50 people 50 different things. I wouldn't say they went underground. I mean, I would say in Detroit, they're kind of underground to start with. I mean, Detroit is a mob family that, you know, is considered kind of the Cadillac of mob families, the Ivy League of mob families around the country. They operate kind of a higher plane, a more educated plane, and they've been able to have the level of success and stability, functionality that not a lot of families are able to have. And so they're always kind of beneath the surface. You know, they live by the mantra, make money, not headlines. And they just kind of went about business as usual after Hoffa disappeared.
Was the disinformation campaign something that was organized or orchestrated, or was it?
I believe the Giacalone brothers like came to a conclusion that we're just gonna tell everyone a different story, and they kind of got their jollies from it. They enjoyed it. They enjoyed kind of building the mythology themselves. And I know a lot of times there's one kind of famous story, and that whenever they'd be down at the Renaissance Center in Detroit, just so for people to have a little background, the Renaissance Center was being built at the summer of 75 when Hoffa disappeared. And one of the rumors is that they stuck him into the foundation of the Renaissance Center. And I don't believe that's true, but the Giacalone brothers like tweaking people, and they'd be down at the Renaissance Center holding business, and they'd be walking around, and they'd have some friends and they would walk past one of the towers of the Renaissance Center. They'd say, hey, say good morning to Jimmy. And then they were leaving that afternoon. They'd say good night to Jimmy.
Just feeding into that whole legend. Yeah. So, Greg, how much of that was something that the FBI had to contend with, a disinformation campaign?
Well, I mean, it was a problem. And you have to remember, this is 1975. So we don't have a lot of the resources or a lot of the investigative tools that we have today. For example, no cell phones. Jimmy Hoffa, we know, made a phone call back to his wife because he was waiting for Tony Giacalone to show up. And he called his wife from a phone in a hardware store close by to Marcus Red Fox and said, have I received any phone calls? Did Tony Giacalone call? Because I'm supposed to meet him and he isn't here. Hmm. And his wife, of course, answered that she had not heard from him. And that was probably, the last time we know of that he spoke to anybody. At any rate, when it was very difficult for us, because of course the mob, to the extent that they talked, they didn't tell us anything useful. And as Scott says, a lot of it was disinformation. Tony Giacalone made an effort, and it was an obvious effort, to establish a strong alibi as to where he was.
It's a guy that never spoke to anybody that he wasn't directly involved with. And he was at his headquarters, which was about a 10-minute drive from the Marcus Red Fox, the Southfield Athletic Club. And Tony Giacalone was going around to everyone in that club, shaking their hands, asking them how their afternoon was. Hey, can I buy you a cup of coffee? And this is a guy that would never, ever have those type of interactions. But that afternoon, he was
everybody
being very friendly
him.
and he was glad-handing his way through the club.
Right.
And let me also just add to what Greg said. In addition to the misinformation campaign or disinformation campaign, you have a group in the Detroit mob that clams up anyway. They don't talk. Nobody talks. In a American mafia where there have been literally hundreds of informants and rats, Detroit has only had one member of the crime family in 100 years to ever turn government informant.
Hmm.
And that was in 2000. So by the time, in 1975, you had a group of people that you weren't going to be able to shake any trees. In Detroit, that was very difficult for these officers because everybody just, shut down, closed up.
So
zip their lips.
So in that regard, Greg, how does that make the FBI's job look different than it might look trying to weed out something among a crime family in Boston or New York where there's a lot more people and maybe it's a little...
There's more informants in those
right,
families.
More informants.
Well, and that was the problem, at least one of the problems, and that is that we didn't have inside information, source information that we could get. Subsequent to that, we picked up some source information and have over the years been able to piece things together as to, small bits of information here and there. And, there's been a lot of speculation about, what happened to Hoffa, why. And I think we were able to, we were able to put together what happened to Hoffa and why. We know the principles involved, but we don't know specifically how it was done or how the body was disposed of.
Is there a period of time where that answer was as close to being realized as possible and there's just no more traction that's been made?
2013.
With the digging up at the farm? Is that what?
Well, there's been a number of farm digs, but the most recent farm dig in 2013 up in Oakland Township, it appeared that that was the biggest lead, the biggest tip the FBI had ever gotten. And it came from a very reliable source. And everyone thought that this was a good chance to break the case wide open. And unfortunately, they didn't.
I think most of the agents that – at least the agents that had been involved in the case early on and had worked it over the years were very skeptical about that. Most of us thought, and we continue to think, that Hoffa's body was destroyed as quickly as possible.
I subscribe to that theory as well.
Not buried. Not buried.
Incinerated. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the places that he – could have been incinerated in, which was a sanitation company called Central Sanitation in Hamtramck, was owned by two Detroit mobsters who were also main co-conspirators in the Hoffa disappearance. They owned Central Sanitation, and it just so happens that in 1977, I believe, Central Sanitation burned down in a suspicious arson fire before the FBI could ever get a search warrant to get in there.
The destroying of any potential evidence.
Yeah. And they were very efficient at that. And they knew that without a body, and if nobody talked, it would be extremely difficult to build a case. And of course, that's proven to be true.
But in some ways, it's actually come back to bite them in the sense that we're still talking about it 45 years later. And I've had some very high-level Detroit mob guys that were – most likely involved in some aspect of the conspiracy, tell me if we had to do it all over again, we just would have left his body on Telegraph Road.
So that nobody would be paying attention
just
to
so
it.
So that it would just be over
years
with.
Later.
And
yeah.
For a family that wants to be in the shadows, the fact that every year, every couple years, the story hits in the national news headlines again because of some dig or some search or, it just brings them back into into the spotlight that they don't want to be in.
I think we're probably – and I can't. No one can say for certain, but I think we're probably as close to the answer as we may ever be. And like I say, we know who was involved and why. And it had to do with the Teamsters Pension Fund, and that was a piggy bank for the mob, not only for the Detroit family but for the entire nation.
It built Las Vegas.
It did. They were able to use that money to build casinos in Las Vegas, and then of course the mob would skim money from, and it was lucrative not only for the mob but also for the Teamsters and for Jimmy Hoffa to some extent personally. Jimmy was his own man, and he would help the mob. It was a symbiotic relationship. He would help the mob because he knew the mob would help him.
And symbiotic rather than kowtowing to them.
Exactly. Whereas
there was a quid pro quo.
Right.
Another term that we're hearing in today's zeitgeist.
Well, I want to wrap up by asking a couple larger frame questions. Greg, I'm curious how the entire saga of trying to unpack what happened to Jimmy Hoffa and his body, how that changed things and the way that the FBI maybe operated or investigated large-scale crime in the Detroit area, or maybe nationally.
Well, and it was national, and it did change. There was a sea change as far as the FBI's priorities. It's sort of a myth that we were not involved in investigating organized crime. We actually started it was after Appalachia when they had this meeting in upstate New York. But we were involved in wiretapping and doing a lot of investigative work in the early 60s. And now in 1975, when Jimmy Hoffa was abducted and probably murdered by the mob, all that did was shine a spotlight on what we were doing and what the mob was doing, what the Teamsters' connection with the pension fund. And it was sort of ironic, but by doing that, the mob did exactly what they didn't want to have done. And that was that ultimately we focused our investigations on union corruption and the mob and those connections. And we set up surveillance squads, permanent surveillance squads to work that. We under the Omnibus Crime Control Act, we got numerous wiretaps. And ultimately, for example, in Detroit, we made a RICO investigation, racketeer influence corrupt organization case against the Detroit family. The point is that we prioritized those investigations. We ultimately took over the Teamsters Union Pension Fund and sort of put it in a trusteeship controlled by the government for a long period of time. The irony of it was put in motion by their abduction of Jimmy Hoffa, who they didn't want to have back in control of the Teamsters Union and the pension fund.
Greg, can I add one more thing that I think is important for context here? I believe, and a lot of other researchers believe, that at the end of Jimmy Hoffa's life, he was a full-fledged FBI informant.
Hmm. Greg, can you comment on an FBI informant?
No.
Well, Scott Bernstein is an investigative reporter and an expert on organized crime in America. Greg Staskel served as FBI agent for 31 years and retired as resident agent in charge of the Ann Arbor office. Scott and Greg, thanks so much for unpacking Hoffa with me. Well, I guess we didn't unpack him, did we?
That's a terrible pun. Let me also just state the Martin Scorsese film is total fiction. See it, and I'm sure it will be a great achievement in cinema, but in terms of historical veracity, it will be lacking very much.
I would agree with that.
Thanks, guys, so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. So typically this time of year, much of America is glued to their NCAA men's basketball March Madness brackets. My bracket looks the same every year with Michigan State winning it all, and this was the year they were going to do it, people. I promise you. C'est la vie. But just for you, Stateside has continued in the vein of March Madness with our March Movie Madness bracket on Instagram with the most quintessential Michigan movies. And we're down to the championship round. The final four were Gross Point Blank, Virgin Suicides, 8 Mile, and Beverly Hills Cop. So we'll get to the championship contenders in just a moment. But first, here to help me make sense and make the case for the best Michigan movies is Corey Hall with the Detroit Film Critics Society and Metro Times. Corey, welcome.
I am so happy to be here.
And we have Andrea Riley, who writes for Movie Sleuth. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
All right. So let's start with Corey. What do you make of this final four?
It's surprising. It's a really surprising bracket. There were some major upsets, and I'm stunned. Frankly,
got left behind that you were expecting to be there?
Well, RoboCop was a real upset to me. That because, I mean, eventually we'll have a statue of RoboCop. We've been hearing since, I think, 1806 that they were going to erect a RoboCop statue. So eventually that's going to be, you know, I mean, it's a very iconic character, and that loss really rattled me. I'm still stunned. I can't even recover.
How about you, Andrea? What did you see on there that wasn't there, actually, that you were missing?
Actually, I'm going to go with Corey on this one. There were some upsets, and I was also especially shocked and appalled by the lack of RoboCop in this Final Four.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to imagine because it's such
a
futuristic Detroit, and it has its second life now as a cult classic with a new generation.
Absolutely.
And so it is a little disappointing. So for me, the big surprise is that Beverly Hills Cop, which is an excellent movie.
Yes.
But has very little to do, even in the title, with the state of Michigan, made it all the way to the Final Four.
I would agree. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Beverly Hills, Michigan, though. Maybe he was going to just Beverly Hills. Do you think Beverly Hills, Michigan?
I don't think so. I think I remember seeing some palm trees, so I would be surprised if it were Beverly Hills, Michigan.
They did shoot some of Beverly Hills Cop in Detroit and made the late, great police chief Gil Hill famous by putting him in the movie. So, I mean, there is that. At least they did, unlike RoboCop, which they shot in like Dallas. They didn't even shoot here. They did shoot some of Beverly Hills Cop in Detroit.
Let's get to the other three movies that are in the final four. Andrea, Gross Point Blank, Virgin Suicides, 8 Mile. Which ones of those jump out to you as being exceptional?
I would say Gross Point Blank and 8 Mile are good contenders for me. Virgin Suicides, not so much because there's nothing really distinctly Michigan in it, except at the very beginning they say that it takes place in Michigan. Outside of that, I would call Virgin Suicides more just distinctly Midwest, whereas 8 Mile and Gross Point not only have a lot of Michigan locations in them, but they also kind of seem to embody the spirit of Michigan for me.
I was surprised by how well Virgin Suicides did, but Grosse Pointe Blank was also not shot in Detroit, but it does actually feel like Grosse Pointe, which is kind of weird. They seem to capture the spirit of that town.
It's so funny. Some of the most Michigan movies as far as filming have nothing to do with Michigan. I was thinking about Youth in Revolt being filmed in downtown Ann Arbor and parts of Michigan. And I was like, yeah, and that has nothing to do with the state. So sometimes those two things don't seem to align.
Exactly. They actually shot that across the street from where I was living, from one location.
When Michigan was once a movie destination.
Ah, yes. Those were the days.
All right. Are you guys ready for our championship round and who made it?
I'm prepared.
Yes, absolutely. Bring it.
Drum roll, please. Da-da-da-da. It is Grosse Pointe Blank got 61% of the vote against Virgin Suicides, against Beverly Hills Cop, which got 52% against 8 Mile.
Huh? Really?
8 Mile got 48%. And let me just tell you, I am in my feelings about this.
I think I am too.
Not only was 8 Mile filmed here,
right,
starring a man from Michigan, a success story out of Michigan, it also featured Detroiters. It was filmed in Detroit locations. It had Michigan references throughout. It talked about the auto industry and working in the plants. And then you have Beverly Hills Cop, which is a banana in the tailpipe. And that's all I can, I am beside myself. And I have to be honest with you, to maintain my journalistic integrity, I tried to pad the vote here because I was so incensed right before I walked in that I encouraged my fellow statesiders to go vote for 8 Mile and we could not move the needle. So my efforts were squashed. But what do you guys think of the matchup?
I will say I prefer Grosse Pointe Blank to Virgin Suicides for this title. So I'm happy with that. And you know, I love me some Beverly Hills Cop. I mean, Eddie Murphy in that movie is fantastic. And I feel like he's a good representation of Detroit, you know, but like you said, it has nothing to do with Michigan. And I think some people voted on what movie they preferred versus what movie is quintessentially Michigan here.
So Corey, let's recap the movies a little bit. Let's talk about the plot line of Grosse Pointe Blank and of Beverly Hills Cop.
Well, Beverly Hills Cop is the story of Axel Foley, who's a plainclothes detective and in Detroit. He's a maverick. He doesn't play by the rules. In typical 80s movie cop fashion, you can't rein him in. But his friend is killed, and he follows the leads all the way to California to find out what happened to his friend who was killed in a bad drug deal. And he gets right up into the business of the very snooty Beverly Hills Police Department, including Judge Reinhold as one of the cops. And remember him? No one. Yeah. And, you know, your typical fish out of water story, and in, like, standard fashion for 80s comedies, it's the slobs versus the snobs formula,
yeah, right,
which Bill Murray did a lot of. But that was really, you know, you have a guy who's uncouth and rude and silly in an environment full of people who enjoy caviar and champagne.
And tell us a little bit about Grosse Pointe Blank.
Grosse Pointe Blank is a story about a guy, you know, as we can all relate to, about a guy who comes back to his high school reunion, having spent the last decade as a professional killer. And we've all been there. But yes, it's John Cusack is a hitman who's having the existential crisis about, you know, can he continue doing this work and what does it really mean? And is he a good person? And he's also got, you know, people he went to high school with who are being real geeks and nerding out around him. And he's got, of course, the girl he left behind. And he's got to reconnect with her and try and find a little sliver of humanity inside himself.
So all things being equal, and let's just say we were just matching these movies based on how good of a movie each one is, which one would you guys go for?
That's a tough one. I like them both in their own way. I mean, Beverly Hills Cop, it's such a, you know, classic comedy from that era, and Grosse Pointe Blank, it's a fun movie too. I would say though, I'm gonna have to give it to Grosse Pointe Blank.
Between these two, it's really, I think Grosse Pointe Blank is technically a better film. It's got a better script. It's more coherent. But Beverly Hills Cop is fun. And that's, you can't beat fun. People loved Eddie Murphy being funny so much that he forgot to do it for 15 years. And now he's come back and people are excited about it. And there's an energy and an excitement to Eddie Murphy's performance in the, and in the 80s, he was everything. He was, in fact, he wore like a Mumford Phys Ed sweatshirt in that movie.
That's right.
And people all around the country who didn't know where Mumford High School was were wearing Mumford Phys Ed sweatshirts. It was a weird phenomenon. You know, he made a lion's jacket look cool, and that's an incredible feat. I think the iconic power of Eddie Murphy and the just pure entertainment value of him is why I think that movie is so popular, even now.
So maybe not the most quintessentially Michigan movie, but an excellent movie nonetheless. So this is not a terrible matchup as far as movies are concerned.
If you put it that way, I might actually go with Beverly Hills Cop, because in that situation, I really want to smile. And Eddie Murphy just makes me laugh like nobody's business. I have a lot of fun with it. Correct.
Sometimes there's movies that aren't great technically, but are have movie magic. And right. I think that's what Beverly Hills Cop does. It has the fun factor.
Absolutely.
All right, so that's our championship round for over the weekend. We want to hear from you on our Instagram page. Go to the Michigan Radio Instagram page and vote between Gross Point Blank and Beverly Hills Cop for the most quintessentially Michigan movie. We'd love to hear from you this weekend. I want to thank Corey Hall. He is with the Detroit Film Critics Society and writes for the Metro Times. And Andrea Riley, who writes for Movie Sleuth. Hey, guys, thanks. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. It's nice to have something to think about that's entertaining.
Likewise. This is a blast. Thanks for having me.
Okay, a quick postscript here. Hold the presses. I kid you not. After we taped this conversation this morning with Andrea and Corey, 8 Mile took the lead right before voting ended, and I am unapologetic that I personally voted for 8 Mile and that I lobbied on its behalf. So the final March movie matchup is Gross Point Blank and 8 Mile, two movies with Michigan right in the title. I am satisfied. Now go vote on Instagram, folks. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham and mixologist Tammy Coxon have scrounged their cupboards to toast to you this weekend with their latest installment of Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. And yes, we are keeping our distance from each other, or at least trying to, but we are going to talk about a drink, being at home. What are all of these bottles?
Well, I don't want to send people out to the liquor store to pick up a specific list of ingredients. So what we're going to talk about today is how to kind of improvise a cocktail with what you have at home.
I take it we're going to, or I'm going to, choose something and you're going to make something from whatever I choose.
That's the idea, a little choose your own adventure game. So we've talked about sours on the show a bunch of times before. We've made whiskey sours, we've made daiquiris and things like that. So all of these are part of a group of cocktails that we call sours, and that just means they have a base spirit, a citrus, and a sweetener. And you can mix and match those. So if you use gin and lime juice and simple syrup, you've made a gimlet. If you use rum and lime juice and simple syrup, you've made a daiquiri. So lots of our classic cocktails kind of fit into this formula. That's the place to start, I think, when you're at home, as long as you have some citrus, ideally fresh. I will modify my only fresh juice rule for the pandemic. But if you have even just a little wedge of lemon or lime to add to some bottled juice, that can brighten the flavor a ton.
Okay, you've got a bunch of spirits here, and they're all Michigan spirits. Very nice. A bourbon, a rum, a vodka, a tequila, and gin. And I'm supposed to pick one of these to make this sour. Is that right?
Yep, go ahead.
All right. Well, I'm going to make it easy. I'm going to pick the bourbon.
All right. So we have bourbon as our base spirit.
And so now you need a citrus.
Yes.
I know that generally speaking, lemon goes really good with bourbon and rye, any kind of whiskey, right?
I think so.
I'm trying to make this easy for you.
Aw, that's very nice of you, Lester.
All right. Now we have to have a sweetener.
That's right. So instead of using just simple syrup, which would make a whiskey sour if we did bourbon, lemon, and simple syrup, we're going to get a little more creative. And, you know, you've probably at home got some random bottle of liqueur sitting around on your cabinet. Maybe you bought it for a cocktail, didn't know what to do with it. So this is an opportunity to bust out those sweet fruity liqueurs or spiced liqueurs and use those as the sweetener in your sour to kind of put a new twist on an old classic.
Okay, some of these look like you got them from a White Elephant gift or something. I mean, I don't know some of these, but okay, this is a ginger liqueur. This is grapefruit. This is spiced pear. That sounds good. I don't know that I've ever run into that. Ancho chili liqueur. That looks really nice. I like that idea, the sound of it anyway. Oh, St. Germain, the bartender's ketchup. That's pretty common. It's elderflower. Very good. So I'm going to go with the spiced pear. Would that work?
Let's make one and find out.
All right, I did a pretty good job with that pear liqueur. That was pretty good stuff.
So I used 2 ounces of the Michigan Straight Bourbon Whiskey from Eastern Kill Distillery in Grand Rapids. Then I used 3/4 of an ounce of lemon juice. And then I started with 3/4 of an ounce of the liqueur. So that's a good baseline formula. But then you're going to want to taste it because different liqueurs have different levels of sweetness. And in this case, the spiced pear liqueur I was using wasn't very sweet. So I added 1/2 ounce of simple syrup just to balance it. And that's, you just shake it up and taste it, and then add a little simple syrup or add more citrus if it's too sweet, and you can kind of adjust as you go.
All right, got that.
All right, well, that was fun. Want to do it again?
Sure. Let's try one. Well, not going to be so easy this time. Let's pick vodka, because it doesn't really bring any taste to the table at all.
But lots of people have vodka at home, so that's a great choice.
Okay, and then let's use the lime you've got over there.
Okay.
And now a sweetener, vodka, lime, and let's try this ginger stuff, this ginger liqueur.
I like that. It's kind of taking us in a Moscow Mule direction, ginger, lime, vodka.
Okay, yeah, I guess so. That makes sense. All right, let's try this. Okay, well, this looks a lot like the previous one, except it's not yellow. It's clear or clear-ish. It's whitish. So let's see what it tastes like. Okay, so it's a sour. Yes, it's a sour. Completely different from the other one, as you might expect, I guess. But I thought the challenge of the vodka would give you a curveball or something, but this has a lot of flavor. It's really delicious.
That's the joy of using a flavored liqueur instead of just simple syrup, is that we've got other places that we can bring flavor in from. So the Domaine de Canton ginger liqueur we use, just adding a lot of flavor here.
Yeah, I say so. So did you make this basically the same way you did the other one?
So I started with that same base recipe that anybody could use to kind of come up with a sour on their own. So that's 2 ounces of the base spirit. In this case, that was 2 James vodka. And then 3/4 ounce of the ginger liqueur. 3/4 ounce of lime juice in this case. And then, just like last time, I tasted it. It needed a little tweak. This time I only added 1/4 ounce of simple syrup this time because the ginger liqueur that we used was sweeter on its own. Plus, I wanted this drink to kind of have a little bit more punch and be a little bit brighter.
Yeah, it's citrusy. It really is. It's nice. Any tips?
Well, we've been saying citrus kind of generically, but for a sour to work, that citrus really needs to be either lemon juice or lime juice. Orange juice and grapefruit juice just aren't tart enough to really balance the cocktail well. If you do want to use orange juice or grapefruit juice, then you'll need to add some lemon or lime just to balance it out.
So the lesson here is kind of crawl through your liquor shelf and see what you've got. You might be able to come up with a drink of your own.
And don't be afraid to experiment. Lots of new drinks were invented when somebody didn't have what they needed to make an old drink.
Necessity, the mother of invention. All right, cheers.
Cheers.
That's it for today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Bear. I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.